response that is similar to gypsy moth, and that several of these inducible volatiles elicit an antennal response, and that methyl jasmonate is increasing the antennal response. So really quick, I'm going to go through the plant resistance study that I conducted. I did a field study where I used control. I treated with nothing, with jasmonic acid, and a grower standard, an insecticide, Intrepid, is a growth regulator. I did 4 replicates per treatment, replicated in the field. I after treatment, I took uprights, placed them in a water pick, and then I placed 3 to 4 neonates per water pick to test for induced resistance. And these are the results that I found for gypsy moth. Here is the percent mortality for the different treatments. There was some constitutive resistance. However, when I induced the plant, you can see that a lot of them died. And it was very similar to Intrepid. When I tested the native species, there was no constitutive resistance against the native species. There was an intermediate effect of jasmonic acid, so there was some inducible resistance compared to Intrepid, that was the most effective, that provided the best control. So just for the general conclusions, jasmonates, as I showed, induce both volatile emissions and resistance in cranberries. However, induced resistance vary between the species that I tested. Induced resistance, the applications that we might get is that induced resistance may help to identify attractants that we can use for controlling insects or for monitoring insect pests. And also, I'm hoping that induced responses may help me to identify the mechanisms of resistance in cranberries. Thank you very much.
Just
acknowledgement.
We have a time for a question.
Rufus.
Have you looked at any of those either induced plants or plants that have already had gypsy moth feeding on and see whether there's an antibiotic response to those plants in this field trial?
I haven't yet. That's a good next step. There's a lot of things that I want to do next year. I think there's also variation throughout the year on how the plant induced defenses. So I want to look at that, and also whether there's any attraction to natural enemies when I induce at different times of the year. There's also whether there's any effect on yield when I treat at different times of the year. So there's a lot of things that I want to explore further. Also, I see differences among resistant among varieties. I use the experiment that I showed was in early blacks. I got a very different response with the Stevens that was very susceptible. So there was no inducible resistance in the Stevens. So I'm going to look at different varieties. Also, one thing that I didn't mention is that jasmonic acid does not have toxicity to gypsy moth. So it wasn't. We sprayed it on top of diet to see whether the toxicity was caused by direct effect of jasmonic acid, and it wasn't. Yes? Jasmonic acid as an attractant. Why do you think that it would be? Yes. Okay.
Can you continue?
Yes. I see what
you mean. Pheromone was reported on recently by 2 groups, and it's unfortunately a pretty complex blend. There are 3 aldehydes, but the 2-component blend of the trine and diene alone will result in the full behavioral repertoire, and this has been confirmed in Florida. So. This blend of the trine and diene are the sort of the behaviorally active pheromone in the U.S. And the reason I say the U.S. is because there appears to be a host race in Japan that uses the diene alone. So the objectives I'll be talking about today were to evaluate the potential of using mating disruption as a new control tactic for this important pest. But coming from Jim Miller's lab, I'm very interested in the mechanisms underlying mating disruption. So, So the studies I'll be telling you about were sort of designed to gain some type of an understanding of mechanisms. And particularly, we wanted to test the predictions outlined by these two recently published Miller et al. Papers that Jim mentioned by developing these moth catch versus dispenser density profiles, which we believe can help us gain insights on whether competitive attraction or false plume following is the operative mechanism versus non-competitive mechanisms such as habituation or camouflage. And then we wanted to also gain some behavioral data to substantiate this. So just our methods in brief, it's really simple. This is just initial proof of concept work. Our release devices are just the simple rubber septa. We load them differently for whether there are mating disruption dispensers versus our monitoring lures. We hang these dispensers about mid-canopy in 4 meter tall trees. We found that that's where these guys hang out mostly. And our trials are conducted in small plots, 30 tree. They're big trees, so it turns out to be about 0.14 hectares. It's replicated 5 times. And as is typical of mating disruption trials, we're evaluating efficacy with monitoring traps that are serving as female proxies. I typically like to use virgin females in these cases, but if you've never seen a citrus leaf miner, they're so small that became impossible. So we've got two of these female proxies per plot, and we're also, of course, from the practical aspect, looking at flush infestation on a weekly basis by looking at 20 shoots from 20 trees per plot. And here are the dispenser densities that we evaluated to develop these profiles. And they range from the control 0 per tree to 1 every 5th tree, 1 per tree, 5 per tree. And you can see what that extrapolation would be on a per hectare basis. And what I'd like to draw your attention to is we're working at what I would consider at least remarkably low amounts of pheromone per area of crop. Our highest AI is only 1.4 grams, and this is about 160 times less pheromone than is typical for disruption of other pests, such as tortrices, where you're typically using about 100 or 200 grams per hectare, or 100 to 200 to get effective disruption. So just to start with some of the data, these are the means for the entire season, and we deployed those dispensers twice, once at the beginning of the season in April, and then once mid-season in June. I redeployed because I got the hint that perhaps efficacy was waning and maybe I jumped the gun on this. But so if we look in this upper panel, this is the mean number of males per trap over season long, and we're getting what I would consider robust disruption, 98% disruption of male orientation to traps. And it are despite the small plot size, our flush infestation was low, which would bode well for using this on a larger scale. As we know, mating disruption works more robustly in a large plot setting. So this is likely due to immigration of females that have very large buffers and they're highly infested. So the disruption is robust. And just to give you an illustration, you know, this is the typical catch of males per week in the untreated control. You're literally catching thousands of moths. So we're up against really incredibly high population densities. So now let's move a little bit to those mathematical predictions that Jim alluded to that he and colleagues developed at Michigan State. And we developed some profiles and mathematical equations that we feel fit the predictions of competitive attraction. And I'm not going to go into this great detail, but these are theoretical data. And in competitive attraction, if you plot catch, which is males per trap, per area of crop, per night, per hectare, against dispenser density per hectare, under competitive attraction, we see this steep initial decline in catches with increasing dispenser density and asymptotic approach. Then we can transform these data to two companion profiles. One is 1 over catch versus dispenser density. This has been coined the Miller-Goop plot. And the second one is catch over dispensers per hectare times catch. And it gives you this nice linear plot with a negative slope. So these are the predictions of competitive attraction. And non-competitive attraction does not share this series of characteristics. For non-competitive attraction, in this untransformed plot, we do not see that steep initial drop in catches. For the Miller-Goop plot, you get this concave shape, it's nonlinear, and this one might be the most diagnostic, is this catch versus dispenser's density times catch. It gives you this characteristic recurved shape, and we believe that non-competitive attraction here operates by subtraction. So those are the theoretical data. Let's see what we actually got with the citrus leaf miner. I think that's a remarkable fit to the predictions of non-competitive attraction. These are the actual data we found. If you look at the untransformed plot, we don't get that initial steep drop. You get this nonlinear plot with a concave shape, and you get the characteristic recurve shape. Now, some may argue that a lot of this depends on this final point, but I think if you look at the profiles as a whole, again, we go back to the theoretical data and what we got with citrus leaf miner, I think it's a really good fit. So now, let's look at the behavior of the moths in the field. The profile analyses would suggest non-competitive attraction, so a prediction of this would be if something like habituation or desensitization is mediating, or a combination of both, disruption in this case, you'd predict that you shouldn't be able to observe these moths, these male moths, approaching dispensers in the treated plots. So we've done a series of behavioral observations at night with night vision goggles when these guys occur. And over 13 nights of two-hour observations and plots treated with all these dispenser densities, we're not able, we've never observed a single male. Here's Wendy Meyer doing her best to see them. But yet if we go to an untreated plot, we can readily observe these males approaching the dispensers. So we're simply not seeing them under mating disruption. Another thing you might ask, well, perhaps those dispensers that we were using as the mating disruption treatment were releasing pheromone above some behaviorally active threshold where males were simply breaking off and plume following and that's why we didn't observe them. Well, we also tested that hypothesis by carrying out a rather long trapping study where we compared the mean number of males caught with the monitoring lure, the disruption dispenser, versus a blank trap. And although we caught fewer males with these higher loading disruption dispensers, we're still able to catch them. So I would say that the bottom line conclusion here is that these dispensers do attract males in a non-treated plot. However, we're not able to see them under mating disruption. So again, I would say that this is further corroborating evidence that disruption in this case is acting by a non-competitive mechanism such as camouflage or desensitization. So to make some conclusions, we can get robust disruption, in my opinion, of this moth season-long with what I consider a remarkably low amount of pheromone per hectare. Flush infestation was reduced even in the small plots. This bodes well for using this technology on a larger scale. The transformation profiles of moth catch versus dispenser density were consistent with non-competitive attraction, and this is sort of a rare case because in the cases where we did do these transformations for other species, we found that the preponderance of cases supported competitive attraction. So this is actually one of the rarer cases. And I contend that the biological data, both the behavioral observations and trapping, are also consistent with the theoretical predictions. Again, this bodes well for control of the species since it occurs at such high population densities. We're lucky that something like non-competitive attraction is operating because it renders the disruption largely density independent, which is sort of the Achilles heel of disruption by competitive attraction. Thanks. Yes, Tom.
One of the other Achilles heels for using aldehydes is that they seem to dimerize and polymerize. And you mentioned that you redeployed them. Do you think there's a issue there that needs to be addressed as far as the longevity of the aldehydes?
Very much so. We were quite excited with how well it was protected and active in this case. I think the non-competitive attraction mechanism, and perhaps it's something like sensory imbalance here, is working in our favor because we might not need that perfectly attractive blend if attraction to the dispenser isn't the operative mechanism. But you bring up the Achilles heel of my problem in trying to approach industry and say, hey, I got this aldehyde, I want you to formulate it for me. So yeah, that's going to be a problem.
That was tackled. People tried to tackle that, but they didn't realize. But maybe the form is,
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. We're going to move on to the next presentation.
I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk at the Tenebrionoid Symposium. As a bit of background for myself, I had actually started out in scarabs, and I conducted the the Scarabioid of Wisconsin for my master's project. I decided to kind of branch out into a different family and landed in the Tenebrionoidea with the Edemeridae, but I still kind of keep my fingers in both of those groups. But I've taken quite a shine to Edemeridae after having done this particular project. I looked at two genera occurring in Edemeridae, and I'll be talking about Sicinia.